Hi, I'm Steve Mabb, Chair of the Australian Shareholders Association, and we're proud to be hosting the 2024 Investor Conference in Melbourne from the 19th to the 21st of May. And we're stoked that Phil, the host of this podcast, is going to be our special guest MC. If you haven't heard much about the ASA conference, it's a flagship event that attracts around 300 investors and industry professionals, including the chair of National Australia Bank this year, the chair of AGL. We have Dr. Sam Hupert, the founder and CEO of ProMedicus, and we've also got Richard White, the founder and CEO of WiseTech, coming along with many others. For a limited time, new members can enjoy special pricing on registration for the upcoming conference, along with a complimentary 12-month digital membership with the ASA. That's 2-day conference registration plus 1-year ASA membership for $499, a saving of $150. Simply search for Australian Shareholders Conference Register, click on 2-day conference non-member, enter the discount code MEM, as in member, 499, the numbers 499, so that's MEM499 to claim your special offer. Come along and meet me and Phil at the conference. We look forward to seeing you there. And I hope you enjoyed this episode of Shares for Beginners.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Shares for beginners.
The advice of a good financial advisor, I think, held Australians in good stead last year. Overwhelmingly, clients were putting money to work at that time. When I say putting money to work, investing in the market as opposed to selling equities, selling shares. It was generally the institutional client bases that we saw around the world that were the ones doing the selling. And it was actually the retail buyer that came in most quickly after the bear market occurred.
G'day, and welcome back to Shares for Beginners. I'm Phil Muscatello. What's macro mean and what does it have to do with your portfolio? What are the great tidal forces that move world markets and pull us little fish around in their undertow? My guest today spends his days planning, strategizing, and generally trying to predict what these forces are and which way they are going. Hello, Anthony.
Hey, Phil.
Anthony Doyle is an investment specialist at Fidelity International. Anthony helps to position Fidelity's broad investment capabilities, strategy, market views, and performance. And we've actually been trying for 2 years to get this happening.
Yeah.
And the reason why, I mean, we talked 2 years ago about coming on the podcast, and you said, well, I'm a macro guy. And I thought, oh, he's a macro guy. That sounds really important. But I've realised, you know, then you collared me at that ASX meeting and said, you know, when am I coming on?
Yeah, yeah, we've had a couple of my friends on, you know, Julian and Kyle.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, you can't let those guys take all the, all the thunder.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah, it was great to finally get on here after a couple of lockdowns and
yes,
a global pandemic.
Right. Yeah, it just took that to get us on air together. So, macro, you are a macro kind of guy.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, in terms of macroeconomics, it is, as you said, you know, the tidal forces, the driving forces of global capital markets.
Yeah.
And you really can't make an assessment of how a business or a company is going to perform without having an understanding of the kind of macro environment that it operates in. Now, a lot of equity investors, a lot of share investors will like to say, oh, I just focus on the company and I look at the business and does it have an economic moat around it? You know, what are the products? What are the competitors? And that's all fundamentally important, of course. But there's no point, for example, choosing the best performing stock in Argentina and it's up 50% when the currency might fall on you by 75%, or the Argentinian government may have defaulted on its debt, or there's been a great geopolitical event, or central banks are raising rates. So when we talk about macroeconomics, when we talk about macro, we're really thinking about what's the business cycle look like, what's economic growth look like, what are the inflationary forces that exist within a economy or the global economy, and what is happening with interest rates, which is where we start looking at the high priests and priestesses of central banks, of the central banking world. And these are really the forces that dominate fixed income investors' minds. You know, what's happening with currencies? What's happening with interest rates? What's happening with corporate bond spreads? Whereas equity investors, they will not be as impacted by these forces to some extent because generally there's a lot more volatility in equity prices. There's a lot more depends upon the stock-specific factors as opposed to these macro factors.
Let's think about the days before COVID. Can you just think back to a time, say, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, and just talk to us about what was happening on the macro side of things and how it was affecting various markets at the time?
I mean, I returned from London middle of 2018, and started with Fidelity at the start of 2019. And that was a really interesting time to come back to the Australian market. I'd been overseas for 12 years in Dublin. That's where I saw the GFC unfurl, and then in London for almost 10 years. So to come back in 2019 with almost a fresh set of eyes as an outsider coming back to the Australian market. And it was extremely interesting domestically in that the coalition government was fixated on a balanced budget despite a rapidly slowing economy, and house prices were even falling at that stage. So you sort of think from the government perspective, they should be stimulating the economy, not going the other way and withdrawing stimulus from the economy from that fiscal perspective. So that's, you know, obviously a macro driver.
So fiscal, that's one of those words, isn't it?
Fiscal, yeah.
That's so what government does.
Government spending, if you cast your mind back to economics 101, high school or uni, you know, growth, economic growth is government spending plus consumption, you know, what we spend money on, services, goods and services, plus investment, plus net exports, so exports minus imports. So if the government is spending, it's going to boost economic growth. If they're implementing austerity, it's going to cause economic growth to be less strong than it would otherwise be.
Yeah.
So that was interesting that the government was following this balanced budget approach. You'll remember Josh Frydenberg with the mug. And then on the other side, you had the RBA, Reserve Bank of Australia, saying we anticipate that the next move in interest rates was going to be up. And this was the environment from Jan until the election of 2019 in May. When we had the election result, the coalition was returned into government. And on, I think it was the Tuesday, the RBA came out and pivoted and said, we're not going to raise interest rates. We actually think we're going to cut interest rates. And then on the Wednesday, APRA came out and reduced its serviceability measures on loans for banks.
So APRA are the
Australian Prudential Regulation.
And they regulate the banking industry.
And loans, right? Mm-hmm. So when we talk about slowing down the housing market, you'll often hear macro prudential measures. And one of those measures is looking at loans and the serviceability of those loans. So the bank, before they give you a mortgage, they will stress test your balance sheet. And previously the test was, could you continue to service this mortgage if the interest rate was 7.25%? And they removed that restriction. So this meant that banks would find it easier to make loans. And again, economic growth should accelerate. More capital, more credit going into the economy means economic growth should accelerate. And guess what? It's also good for banks because banks make profit off those mortgages, off those loans. So that was the domestic environment. So all of a sudden you had what had been an environment where there were headwinds to economic growth turn around into tailwinds for economic growth. And that had a boost for consumption. And if you think about consumer discretionary sectors, that would be the sector that would benefit from that. You know, we're talking about buying, you know, household items or whether it's a JB Hi-Fi or a Harvey Norman. And if you think about the banks, they benefit from that. And then from the global perspective, in 2019, there was the famous Powell pivot. So this guy, Jay Powell, is the chairperson of the US Federal Reserve, the world's most important central bank.
Central banker, yeah.
We say that China sets growth for the world, but the US sets interest rates for the world. So when the US moved their interest rates, it's extremely important. It affects the cost of capital all around the globe. And because the US dollar is the world's reserve currency, there's so many contracts that are priced in US dollars, including commodity contracts. So when we talk about the Fed doing the Powell pivot, so Powell's the guy in charge, he said that we were raising interest rates and he pivoted to saying, oh, we might actually start reducing interest rates. So all of a sudden, global and domestic headwinds from that credit liquidity perspective turned into tailwinds, and we saw equity markets respond accordingly. So that's how some of the macro factors from almost 3 years ago sort of set up the rally in the ASX 200 at that time to 7,000 points in January 2020. And then we know what happened, obviously, in March 2020.
We've talked about that way too much. I want to look at other factors, except, you know, we are in a bull market at the moment, aren't we?
Sure, yeah. If
you consider... this is what you would consider a bull market par excellence, really, wouldn't you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the ASX 200 is up around 60% since the low of March 2020. You know, for a bull market, it's not a science. There's no strict rule. A bear market traditionally has been a decline of 20%. Or more. But yeah, we're definitely in a bull market. But one thing we would say is, again, going back to that cyclical element of the business cycle, we would say that we've moved from a early stage part of the business cycle to more mid-cycle now, where the initial return from equity markets starts to become a bit more fatigued. Those initial returns are fantastic when the business cycle turns, when it goes from bad to less bad, and that becomes quickly priced into the market. So the outlook from here is that the growth in equity markets that we've experienced, it's unlikely that we're going to see those type of returns. You know, 60% in 18 months, you know, it's going to be very hard to generate that sort of return profile.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to reflect on this because there's a lot of people who've never really experienced a bear market. It feels like markets just go up, and it's been going that way for a long time, doesn't it? Apart from that little glitch.
Well, the last bull market after the GFC lasted 10 years. I mean, bull markets don't die of fatigue.
Yeah.
And there's a famous saying from a Fidelity portfolio manager, Peter Lynch. I'm sure many of your listeners may have read his books that are quite, you know, held up as, you know, anyone getting started investing, have a look at some of Peter Lynch's books. And his saying is, there's more money lost preparing for a bear market than there is in the actual bear market itself, you know, meaning that, oh, I think the market's expensive. I'm going to go 100% into cash because I have utmost safety. The market could rally another 20% before you see a correction in that sense. So, you know, in terms of bear markets, they are normally short and swift, but brutal at the time. You know, we have lived through one in March last year. The other bear market was really 2008, 2009. The difference this time around is traditionally central banks will cut interest rates to support their economies, and that has a stimulating effect on equity prices. This time around, we're close to zero. I mean, an interest rate of only 0.1%. So the next real recession bear market, a lot of analysts and economists are questioning how can central banks stimulate to the same extent that they have historically done during recessionary periods.
Tell us about Fidelity. What does Fidelity do and what's your specific role in it? What are you doing when you first go into the office and turn your computer on?
Yeah, well, I forgot what it's like going into the office. Well, but
the home office, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, thankfully we're starting to open up again and we can start to return back to the office. So Fidelity International is one of the world's largest investment managers. So there are over 400 investment professionals. And when I say investment professionals, people that manage money, people that analyze companies, people that invest across different asset classes like bonds, shares, commodities, currencies. And of course, we have a very large footprint. We're in over 26 different countries, office in 26 different countries, but the head office is in London. So I'm in Sydney. My role in Fidelity is to represent the investment teams that are offshore, that aren't in Sydney, to our Australian client base, which include mums and dads, you know, people that invest in our active ETF on the Australian Stock Exchange, to financial advisors, to superannuation funds, and to CIOs and family offices and endowments. And I articulate the views of Fidelity in terms of our house view, what is going on in the macro environment, what asset classes are attractive. But we have a team of 14 investment professionals in Sydney. We were established in Australia in 2004, and we run a number of funds for our clients in Australia. So there are around 16 funds that we, mutual funds, unit trusts, that we have here available for clients and investors to invest in, ranging from Australian equities, run by a portfolio manager named Paul Taylor. So he's very well known in the industry. He's in the Hall of Fame of fund managers. Another person that's well known within the industry, writes a regular column for the Australian Financial Review, is Kate Howitt. She also runs an Australian equity portfolio named the Fidelity Australian Opportunities Fund. And then more recently, there's a portfolio manager named James Abella, who has run Australian small companies fund, mid and small companies fund, named the Fidelity Future Leaders Fund. And that's generated some very strong performance, and he's won a few awards for being one of the best portfolio managers in Australia. And they're all backed up by this team of equity analysts that analyze the companies, you know, to the nth degree. So we get company management have historically, you know, under normal circumstances, they'll come into the office and they'll have the CEO of BHP or the CEO of CBA and their senior management teams, you know, they'll grill them on what's going on, what's the competitive landscape, all with the hope of identifying those companies that can generate returns over and above, say, a benchmark index exposure. So a lot of different funds that Australian investors can use. But of course, with being a very large investment organisation, we have a lot of resources available to us. So I talk to my colleagues in Shanghai, Singapore, Hong Kong, Toronto, of course, London, all around the world. So that's the great thing about being a large organisation. If I don't know the answer to something, I'm sure there is someone within our organisation that does.
So that's your role, is the macro sort of role. I'm assuming that there's all of these investment managers choosing different stocks and companies and analysing them to the nth degree. And your particular role is to overlay the macro view. Is that a fair enough way of putting it?
Yeah, so I cover Australia and New Zealand as part of my role as well, and we'll give a view on how I think interest rates are going to move in Australia. I'll give a view on, and in terms of Australian capital markets, what I think represents good value, whether that be the Australian equity market or the bond market or the currency, and similarly for New Zealand. So I'll feed those views into our global macro team and our global view. But also I regularly interact and sit in on team meetings with the multi-asset team, where we're looking at various regions for where we can find those opportunities for our portfolios. Whereas your portfolio managers, the people that you've had on in the past, you know, someone like Kyle McIntyre from Firetrail or Julian McCormack at Platinum, for example, they'll be far more focused on the individual companies,
yes,
which is what their roles are, for example, as, you know, equity analysts. They'll be far more focused on the domestic landscape. And, you know, if a company has global, they'll think about some of the global markets as well. But as a macro, I mean, my background is I was trained as an economist. I worked at Macquarie Bank for 5 years as an economist. And that really lends itself a lot more to thinking about growth, inflation, interest rates. You know, my hesitancy in coming on, you know, originally was that I wouldn't be someone, you tap up for the next
stock pick,
10 bagger or 5 bagger. You know, it makes me laugh when people tap me up because I don't really have, you know, that insight. But I could tell you, for example, if what regions in the world look like good value from that market perspective.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
So getting back to the fact that we're in a bull market, how should investors be approaching purchasing equities at this stage?
I mean, it's really interesting. So this is where the insights of behavioral finance and behavioral economics can help guide you on your investment journey. So, you know, one of the worst things you can probably do from studies that have been conducted is look at your portfolio on a daily basis. And there was a guy that won the Nobel Prize, Richard Thaler, in 2017. And he's seen as one of the fathers of behavioral economics. And he said, you know, one of the best things I've done is not look at my portfolio at all. And he wrote a famous paper in 1994 saying that you should just invest 100% in equities. And this isn't obviously advice or anything like that. Everyone has different risk profiles, but historically speaking, you know, equities have been a great place to invest. And obviously during the bear market of last year, I had a lot of clients talking to me about what they should do. Should they be selling? Should they be buying? And one of the best things you can do during periods of volatility or bull markets such as this, obviously you look at valuation measures, you look at whether the fundamentals of the market are strong, you look at whether the valuations represent cheapness, fair value, or are expensive. And you also look at technical factors, like whether there are flows coming into and out of the market. But one of the best things you can do, and one thing that I was highlighting last year, was that one of the best things to do is to extend your time horizon of investing. So on any given day, there's a higher probability that the market is up than down, because markets generally trend higher over time, because guess what? The economy is growing, which is, again, that link back to macro. So there's a 54% probability that the market is up from 1979, the ASX 200, in total return terms. Whereas if you extend your time horizon to 5 years, no one has lost money. Even if you bought the day before a huge bear market, like Black Monday in 1987, like the tech crash, like the GFC, like COVID-19, obviously you have experienced great volatility, great falls at the time, but after 5 years in total return terms, you're up. So this is the way that generational wealth thinks. Long-term investors. This is the way that superannuation funds think. This is the way that endowments think, family offices. And too often, we get caught up in the noise. And the reason is, again, going back to those behavioral insights, we feel losses far more acutely than we feel windfall gains, which is why we're so hesitant to sell a company at a loss, because of that loss aversion, which is why so many investors will hold on until they get back to their entry level, when you should really be assessing a company if you are looking to sell on the fundamentals then and there, as opposed to, you know, any sort of price target that you might have in mind. So one of the best things to do is extend your time horizon. And I often talk to investors and they'll say, I'm a long-term investor, I'm patient capital. But when it seems like the world is going to hell in a handbasket and the headlines are screaming at you.
And everyone's running from the door.
And everyone's running, and everyone's investment time horizon collapses to a day, to a week. So having those goals in mind when you're investing, understanding your own time preference of money, understanding what liabilities you might have as well. Often we see that those that are forced to sell because of margin calls, these are sophisticated investors, leverage like hedge funds, they're forced sellers. Even if you see some of the crazy price action on individual stocks, it might be short covering. They've been short and they've had to buy back the stock.
Which has the effect of increasing the price.
Exactly. This
explosively.
Is Tesla, one of the most shorted stocks, obviously, and you've seen the price action there too. This is, you know, just noise, really. It is fundamentally noise. And again, when you think about the evolution of humans from the African savannas, we're hardwired to fear things. You know, is that a stick over there or a snake? And this is why when you open a paper, it's not good news you're reading, right? It's always, you know, but that's what's going to attract your attention. That's what's going to get your eyeballs. And in this world of social media and amplification of messages, it's something that you have to be really acutely aware of. And, you know, to tell you the truth, the advice of a good financial advisor, I think, held Australians in good stead last year. Overwhelmingly, clients were putting money to work at that time. When I say putting money to work, investing in the market as opposed to selling equities, selling shares. It was generally the institutional client bases that we saw around the world that were the ones doing the selling. And it was actually the retail buyer that came in most quickly after the bear market occurred. So that's something to consider as well. So I would say that an important lesson is that being liquid, what we call, you know, having a large cash buffer in place when you can deploy, when markets do have those sell-offs, is another good way, you know, tilting into risk is another good way to generate long-term returns as well.
It's interesting that you say that, that retail investors were the ones that were holding their heads high and institutional investors were the ones selling, because Gemma Dale, who was on a few months ago now, was mentioning, because she's got a lot of data about what people are buying, and there were younger retail investors buying banks, buying BHP, just buying Wesfarmers and those regular stocks. And it seems to be a real turnaround that they're keeping their heads as opposed to the institutional investors.
Well, again, remember when I spoke about the time preference of money? Yeah. The great advantage that the retail investor has is they're not reporting their returns on
it's the quarterly, monthly, annual,
yeah, three-year return cycle. The professional investors, it's very visible whether they're underperforming or outperforming their index, and it attracts inflows, or you might have redemptions from your portfolio as a result as well. So retail investors have a great advantage in that they can extend their time horizon, and they can also withstand volatility to a much greater extent relative to the institutional professional portfolio managers. So that is a great advantage that retail investors have in terms of the time preference of money. They aren't forced sellers when the volatility occurs. A lot of the times, as a professional money manager, your fund may be facing withdrawals. So you have to meet those withdrawals by selling equities when you might not want to sell them. And the reverse, again, as a good portfolio manager, they will typically be liquid enough to deal with those sort of redemption profiles. But guess what? A lot of professional portfolio managers aren't like that. They chase returns. So again, doing your due diligence on individual companies and shares, you should do the same sort of due diligence on fund management firms, like a Fidelity, for example. You know, do your due diligence on our strategy. Look at the return profile, look at the volatility, look at the Sharpe ratio, look at the competitors that we're competing against, and see if our funds stack up. And I'm confident that they will. They don't all, of course. I'm confident that they will. But definitely do your due diligence when you're looking at an active ETF or a unit trust as well.
So you don't have a short-term incentive in place, or there's short-term imperatives at Fidelity?
No, portfolio managers are remunerated on their performance against a benchmark. So all the funds have benchmarks. So the Australian Equity Fund will try and outperform the ASX 200 in total return terms. So there is a quantitative element in terms of the performance of the fund itself, and also a qualitative element as well in terms of, you know, teamwork and the contribution to Fidelity as a business and things like that.
So you're looking at emerging markets as well. What's the definition of an emerging market, and what are you seeing there for investors at the moment?
So there's some confusion around that definition of an emerging market. So the international...
Because is China an emerging market? It's not really. It's considered an emerging market, isn't it?
So Singapore, South Korea. So you go to these places, they're pretty developed, right? Malaysia as well. So you go to these places, they're pretty developed. The International Monetary Fund will tell you that there are around 137 emerging market nations, or low-income nations, developing nations. Basically anything that's not a developed market. And they will classify an emerging market according to things like gross domestic income per capita and standards of living and things like that. So we're a very wealthy nation, Australia. We punch well above our weight in terms of our population relative to our economic growth. And I think our GDP per capita, or our gross national income per capita, is around $70,000 to $80,000 US. We're one of the world's wealthiest nations.
Yep. And our GDP, weren't we about 13th in the world? Or
I think,
something like
that. We're in the top 20. We're just on the cusp of the top 20, if not in the top 20. What a result, right, for a country of 25 million people. Whereas, you know, low-income nations, they might have a GDP of $1,000 per person or even less. Now, that's the IMF definition, the International Monetary Fund. The ratings providers, the index providers, like MSCI, they classify emerging markets according to the depth of their capital markets and the liquidity of their capital markets and the development of their financial systems. So according to MSCI, who is the index provider of emerging markets, generally the broad vanilla index, MSCI Emerging Market Index, they'll tell you there's 27 nations, because a lot of those countries are uninvestable. They just don't have the equity market, the depth, the liquidity. So we're talking about countries that range across a number of continents. We're talking about Asia. So we're talking about China, Malaysia, Singapore, Vietnam, I'm sure you can think of other countries, Latin America. So we're talking about Brazil. We're talking about Mexico. We're talking about Peru. And, of course, we're talking about Eastern Europe, the Middle East and Africa. So places like Poland, places like South Africa, places like nations in the Middle East as well. So 27 nations, very large investment universe. In the index, I think there's around 13,000 companies. They're just the companies that are in the MSCI Emerging Market Index. There's more, obviously, outside of that. And, of course, the majority of the world's population reside in these nations as well. So,
Is India an emerging
yes,
market?
Yes, India is an emerging market.
Yeah, so it is going to be.
Yeah, so of almost course, the majority so you're looking at you know, China, India,
Brazil,
Indonesia, Brazil, Russia. Yeah. So, yeah, you've got a huge populations that are continuing to develop. And, again, bringing it back to the macro, generally a stronger economic growth outcome will lead to higher standards of living for the individuals that reside in those nations. And, of course, they're coming from a low base. But your listeners may be surprised that the majority of the world's growth today comes from the emerging markets.
Really? I suppose mature economies, they're mature.
And they're not going to go anywhere, really. The biggest contributor to economic growth is a growing population. So the mature economies, the developed economies, they're at a higher base, but they also have deteriorating demographics in that a lot of people are older and they may be retired. So generally you have a smaller proportion of a nation's population that are actually in the workforce doing the hard yakka, whereas the other people are rightly enjoying their retirement. So a growing population is one of the reasons why Australia avoided a recession for 30 years. And while we're in one at the moment, is our international borders are shut. Because if you think about it, if you have a growing population, well, then you have, you know, a child and they grow up, they leave the nest, hopefully, you know, 24 and out the door or whatever the case may be. They find a partner, they establish a home, they buy a house, they fill the house full of stuff, they have kids, the kids need stuff. You know, this is all economic growth. This is contributing to generating a stronger economic growth profile over time. So you combine that population growth with productivity growth, so the workforce is working more productively, and that's generally what you will get to stimulate economic growth and higher standards of living for the population.
So if someone was interested in investing in emerging markets, what are some of the vehicles that are available?
Well, speaking of Fidelity, so we have a unit trust, the Fidelity Global Emerging Markets Fund. So the unit trusts are that Global Emerging Markets Fund, we have a Fidelity India Fund, we have a Fidelity China Fund, we have a Fidelity Asia Fund. So you can look at broadly global emerging markets. The benefits are a more diverse, disparate investment universe that is available to our portfolio managers to invest in. And we have 45 analysts that specialize in emerging market companies. And importantly, we're on the ground. So we have an office in Shanghai, we have a large team in Mumbai. We're in with all these regions. So we're there, you know, investing in Latin American companies, and we have a very large team working together in order to identify those opportunities for our portfolios and articulate that to our portfolio managers. So that's the unit trust side of things. If your listeners are familiar with unit trusts,
they're not actually. We've never really talked about funds.
Oh, really?
Well, we talk about ETFs all the time because, you know, they claim all the glory.
Yes, of course.
But before ETFs, people had unit trusts and managed funds.
And LICs, of course.
Oh, and LICs, of course.
As well. So these are not exchange-traded products.
Yeah.
So you will go...
Well, LICs are.
LICs are, yes. Yeah. So unit trusts aren't. Yeah, correct. Yeah.
So you have to buy these...
Through the firm. Yeah, yeah. Through the investment manager that owns the product.
It's incredible now just to think that, you know, a few short years ago, these were the only ways that you could really invest, you know.
Well, active ETFs have been such a game changer.
Yeah,
and you're now seeing dual listed as well. So
that's
whatever
right,
your
yeah.
preference is. I'm sure there's someone...
I think Julian's got a few of those, hasn't he?
I know Magellan do, and we are doing it as well going forward.
It was Magellan. They're the ones that have...
Magellan, I think, have been in the forefront of it.
Yeah,
So I think that's the way... the world is traveling, and we're certainly headed in that direction as well, depending on the preference of the investor, whether they want to get exposure, say, to emerging markets via unit trusts, so they come through Fidelity, or whether they buy on the Australian Stock Exchange, which is our active ETF. The ticker is FEMX. And the reason it's dual listed, essentially, the benefits of that is they're the same fund, they're the same portfolio manager, same team. that there will be slight differences in terms of cash flows. The unit trust might be an inflow and the active ETF may not be, and vice versa. But generally, what you find is that they mirror. They'll have very similar performance. So I think it's quite unique to Australia. I think Canada is another market that has active ETFs. But when I came back, I had to educate myself on this because I'd been used to investors getting exposure via unit trusts in Europe and the UK. And I think it's just a fantastic way that democratizes the ability of investors to get access to these hard to access parts of the world for themselves. You know, I've spoken in the past at presentations and I've identified companies that Australian investors just had no idea. You know, one is Tektronik, right? So if they've gone to Bunnings and they've bought a Ryobi hand tool, well, it's a Hong Kong domiciled company that own Ryobi and Hoover.
Yep.
I've spoken in the past about the guy that lit the Olympic cauldron at the 2008 Beijing Olympics. He's got a company called Li Ning, a sports manufacturing and equipment company that's up, you know, I think around 300, 400% in the last couple of years. No one had heard of Li Ning. And obviously he's, you know, extremely household name in China, for example, I mean, having that Cathy Freeman type profile. So there's just a plethora of opportunities in these markets, emerging markets, where they can follow the sort of growth trajectory that we've seen, say, an Amazon have or a Netflix have in terms of the tech areas, but also they are increasingly competing with developed market companies on other areas, not only tech, but healthcare and finance, and they have huge markets that they can tap into. Remember, Australia, our population is 25 million, and I think the adult population is around 18 million, right? Whereas you look at China and you're talking about 1.4 billion people and you're talking about a global middle class that's growing by around 850 million in the next 10 years and most of that in Asia. And for anyone that's traveled, no one's traveled in the last couple of years, but you go to these areas and you see how dynamic they are, and there are companies that can tap into that growth. I think increasingly Australian investors will have to have an allocation to emerging markets. They haven't historically had to. They've been really spoiled by the returns that they've been able to generate by just being invested in Australian assets.
Yep.
But in a world of ultra low interest rates where the cash rate may not move for years, the RBA is telling us 2024, maybe 2023, term deposits yield nothing. Increasingly, I think Australians will want to allocate to riskier parts of the world with the aim of generating those higher returns and help them meet their investment and savings goals over a long period of time.
You write a lot of interesting articles for Fidelity. Where can listeners access these articles?
I mean, the great thing at Fidelity is, as I said, there's a lot of clever people and we regularly interview them on webinars. You know, I write a lot as well. So we want to really democratize our research and provide that to clients or prospective customers. And the best place to look at for any of that information is our website, fidelity.com.au. But we host investment seminars and webinars where we'll have on a geopolitical expert or our team that have been focused on COVID-19 and the development of vaccines or particular companies that may or may not benefit from the reopening trade and access to, you know, some of the best thinkers within Fidelity, access to someone like Paul Taylor, you know, Hall of Fame portfolio manager that's been investing in Australian equity since 2004 and some of the lessons that he's learned over his investment career as well, or talking to Kate Howard. So it is really a great place. We have the resources that we can help investors on their journey, and we specifically focus content on those investors that are perhaps new and feel a little bit overwhelmed. We have investor-specific content for them as well at our website, fidelity.com.au.
Oh, well, we'll put links in the blog post so people can follow up and learn some more.
Of course, they can contact me as well on LinkedIn or anything like that. I'm more than happy to have a chat.
Oh, fantastic. Anthony Doerr, thanks very much for coming in today.
Thanks, Phil.
If you found this podcast helpful, please tell a friend, especially if it's someone who needs to start thinking about investing for their future. You'll be helping them and helping me to keep this show on the road.
Shares for Beginners is for information and educational purposes only. It isn't financial advice, and you shouldn't buy or sell any investments based on what you've heard here. Any opinion or commentary is the view of the speaker only, not Shares for Beginners. This podcast doesn't replace professional advice regarding your personal financial needs, circumstances, or current situation.
And thank you for listening to my podcast.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.